Hi, podcasters. This is Lisa Henderson, Editor-in-Chief of Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm without my co-host, Andy, today. But we have a great episode, and I'm speaking with Rose Blackburn, MD, MBA, Vice President, Global Head General Medicine for PPD Clinical Research, Thermo Fisher, and Margarita Nunez, MD, Principal Investigator with Synexus New York at Accelerated Enrollment Solutions. So thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So we have Dr. Blackburn, that you were a practicing OBGYN physician for many years before joining the world of pharma, where you started at IQVIA, which was Quintiles at the time, and now you've been with PPD for the past 7 years. And Dr. Nunez, you were with Synexus since 2018, and prior you served as medical director and principal investigator for High Point Clinical Trials Center from 2013 to 2017. So you both have a lot of experience in the medical and trials field. So I'm glad that you can share that with us today. So Dr. Blackburn, the FDA diversity action plans are certainly on top of mind for industry right now. What are your company's recommendations for these plans, and who is the primary stakeholder in shaping these plans?
Great question, Lisa. So the clinical trial sponsor or product developers, CROs, and patients are all stakeholders. But I would say the primary stakeholder for submitting diversity action plans are the drug trial sponsors or the product developers. PPD is very excited to support our clients and customers at their request to help them develop a plan and a strategy to be compliant with the diversity plans. So CROs are really well placed for this because we play a critical role in trial design and execution, bringing different innovative features to clinical trial in the clinical trial space. What's critical for the FDA diversity plans is that we think about how to address bias in healthcare, understanding what the barriers are for patients to participate, understanding who clinically relevant and underrepresented populations are for different diseases based on disease epidemiology. In these strategies, we help them develop our epidemiologic, data-driven, and scientifically driven to get the best and most appropriate people into clinical trials and make them accessible for different populations.
So what are you hearing most from clients? Are they don't know where to start?
Exactly. So a lot of times it's, where do we start? We're at phase three already. Does that mean we have to go back? What do we need to do? The plan. So the good news is that there are a lot of questions. So it's on everybody's radar. And I think sponsors are trying to understand what they need to do, what the plan entails, and how we can support them and what needs to be done to make sure that their trials meet the regulation. So there are questions. I think the plan is well laid out. The guidance is pretty straightforward. There's some areas that there tends to be a lot of questions about in terms of when to start, when to speak to the FDA, when to request a meeting, how does it play for a global trial? Is global data going to be acceptable? So all of those are probably representative of the questions that we're hearing from sponsors.
Excellent. Thank you. So Dr. Nunez, as a principal investigator, how difficult is it to make clinical trials inclusive? So what biases do you see in trials? What steps can you take to address biases?
I think, as Rose mentioned, it really starts with pharma, the way the protocols are written, the inclusion-exclusion criteria. Of course, you know, they are looking at scientific reasons for choosing the inclusion-exclusion criteria. My job is to implement it, right? Mm-hmm. My job is to follow the protocol and choose the right subjects for this. So when I look at a protocol, I try to decide, is this the right fit for my community? You need to know your community. And then if you have subject populations who fit the criteria, are you going to be able to reach them, right? I've actually had a little bit longer experience than what you mentioned. One big part of my training, actually, I did academics for the first few years of my life as a physician in Florida. And then I ran a clinical trial site for 16 years in St. Petersburg. And at that time, we weren't really talking that much about diversity. I am so glad that we have this conversation and that really things are moving forward. And it's a very exciting time for me. This is why I agreed to do this. But back then, I was in a site where the focus was Alzheimer's disease. And my mom died of Alzheimer's disease. I'm a Hispanic woman. And we really had a hard time recruiting that patient population in Hispanics. I knew that the minority population in our country has a higher incidence of Alzheimer's disease. And at that time, we couldn't really reach them. They were mostly white subjects. Even though I spoke Spanish, even though, you know, we were willing to translate the consents. So those are all, to me, that said, okay, it's education. People don't know enough about the clinical trial world, what the opportunities are. Because of abuses in the past, there is some real mistrust of the system, and there's a reason for that. But what we, like, even back then, I joined the support groups and Spanish support groups, and I partnered with the free clinic, and I would go and volunteer my time, like one day a week, just so that I could tell people that we even exist. You know, that was back then. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then I went to North Carolina, and that was surrounded by, in High Point, we're surrounded by a rural community. Although High Point is, you know, it's a city, and it was very diverse, but again, it was early phase. So at that point, I did have a little bit more of a say in the protocol. When you're doing early development, the sponsor comes to you very early on. And like Rose was saying, as a CRO, and, you know, phase one units often act with or as CROs, and you could have a little bit more influence in the protocol. You could say, okay, well, maybe if you changed this criteria or that criteria, then you could have a more inclusive population. And back then, what we did was, we got a mobile van and we went out into the communities so we can reach some of the more rural areas. And phase one, people come from all over because they're inpatient and they're well compensated. So you almost have to be careful that you're not, because of the compensation, it attracts a more, I guess, socioeconomically underserved population because of the compensation can be very attractive. And then when I came to New York, my barriers were different. I had a site out in Queens and it was away from the center of the city and patients had a difficult time getting to the site. And fortunately we were able to move and now we're in the center of the city. So transportation is an issue. You have to make sure that not only are subjects educated, we have community outreach. Those are the barriers, and I guess I'm jumping kind of to the solutions, because once you realize what the barriers are, why are subjects not volunteering? Why do they come in or may not come back? Sometimes I heard from someone actually at this past conference, sometimes the no-shows tell you a better story than the ones who show, because you have to reach out, find out what it is that made them not come back. And sometimes it's not seeing themselves in the people when you walk into the site or how you are treated. So to me, those are the barriers and those are the things that are now at the forefront that we've always known, but it's never been formally acknowledged. Or like saying, okay, we have to do something about this.
Right, you make a really good point. And I'm sorry that I missed your previous background in my introduction, but you do make a really good point. You know, 16 years ago when you were doing the Alzheimer's trial in Florida and, you know, we weren't talking about these things then. I mean, the industry has talked about it, but as you mentioned, it's never been at the forefront. So you brought up a lot of the challenges and the barriers. You also mentioned the event that you went to, that you both attended the Health Equity in Clinical Trials Congress in Boston. That was last month. So how did you find the event received overall? You know, we're talking about this very large, very difficult and complex problem. And so how did you both find the event received? I'll start with you, Dr. Nunez, since you just finished.
I felt it was very well received. I was telling Rose just yesterday that I went in thinking, oh, I'll just do this because someone asked me to do it and I'll just get it done. And so I came back the same day. Mm-hmm. So I did hear the first day And I wish so badly that I hadn't had to leave, because it was to be surrounded by all these people who have this on their forefront and who are excited about doing something. And I found that it was a very exciting atmosphere. It was a little bit charged for me. It was great. So I don't know what Rose's experience was, but to me, I was thrilled to be there and listening to these very just experienced people saying, this is what we need to do, and we're going to do it now.
Excellent, Dr. Blackburn.
Yeah, I echo Margarita's comment, and I'll take a step back. We were excited because we were one of the title sponsors for the event, and it was one of the first times that as an organization, we were able to sponsor a conference solely focused on health equity. So it was important for us, and we were excited to do it and be kind of in on the ground floor of an event like this. The other exciting part was that the audience included the entire clinical trial ecosystem. So sponsor companies in pharma, biotech, with their health equity and diversity and clinical trial team leads, patient advocacy organizations, vendors that focus on working in diverse communities, and we had representatives from the FDA. So it was a nice holistic approach and discussion, and everyone was, as Margarita mentioned, just completely engaged and passionate about this topic. Some of the take-homes were that the diversity plan goals need to really be embedded as part of the corporate business plans, you know, whether it's, a pharma, biotech, patient advocacy organization, a CRO. Mm-hmm. And then they need to be cascaded down to the study team level. So, and all the steps in between. There was also a lot of discussion around prioritizing early phase and phase two, not just waiting for the phase three, even though that's a key part of the diversity plan expectation. And then including all the functional teams, so clinical operations, medical writing, program leads, pharmacovigilance, commercial, marketing, and then ultimately market access, because as you talk about developing the drug, you want to make sure the drug or the product is accessible once it's approved. And then there was a big discussion and focus around how to include community-based site networks and organizations that have networks and relationships within diverse communities. Again, as Margarita mentioned, that's a key piece to getting and reaching all of the right patients and communities in a trial. And then while FDA is a big driver, we also talked a lot about how diversity is addressed globally and how there are different definitions for diversity and representation in different regions. And then there's an ongoing collaboration between FDA and other agencies to build out these guidances so that the regional differences in disease trajectories, different cultures, how race and ethnicity is captured differently in different parts of the world, all of those things are embedded at the heart of this. And that I think patient centricity is critical and not forgetting the patient in all of this. So it was a very robust discussion for 2 days.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That global piece is extremely interesting. I hadn't even, you know, thought about that or considered that the other global regulatory agencies were, you know, working together already. So that's exciting. Yeah. That'll be exciting to watch out for. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you both also participated on a panel at the Congress that was entitled Best Practices for Effectively Communicating Health Equity Strategies in Clinical Trials. I'm sorry, I don't have the other speakers on my screen right now, but speaking from your side, the CRO side and the site side, how are organizations responding? And in this panel, what did you find was, you know, how you're driving these health equity strategies in clinical trials? I'll start with you, Dr. Blackburn.
Great question. So our panel consisted of one of the sponsor company representatives in patient diversity, one that we collaborate with from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and one of the patient advocacy site network organizations, Acclinate, and myself and Dr. Nunez, and then PPD's Director of Patient Diversity, Lauren Hubbard. So we had a nice cross-functional group, and we talked about a couple of things, how pharma, biotech, can really lead addressing health equity by thinking about disease outcomes and safe treatments. We also kind of covered a lot of what Margarita mentioned already about the barriers to accessing trials and how to overcome them. So not just stating the problems, but what our solutions are and how, you know, we're all on the journey together. So, you know, we work together to make sure that we're compliant and we're thinking about how to embed what the diversity plan expects, how we can be motivated around addressing health equity, and how, you know, having the right patients ultimately leads to the product, medical products that are safe for everybody. So it was a nice way of hearing from the different parts of the clinical trial and development ecosystem.
Dr. Nunez, do you have anything to add to what you took away from your panel?
Really echoing what Rose said, because there are people approaching it from all different perspectives, right? It definitely, pharma is a big, big stakeholder there. But then the community piece, you know, how do you get patients to know about clinical trials? To me, you know, I'm a huge education proponent. To me, that's the answer to like almost everything that Ailes says. Mm-hmm. Information, like, but it starts with physicians. It starts with everyone. I'm going to tell a little anecdote. One time, a long time ago, I was doing a diabetic trial, and I had this nice woman who, like, you know, obviously to get in the trial, she had to have a hemoglobin A1C that meant that her diabetes was not well controlled. And so I felt great about putting her in the trial. You get so much more attention that you get while you're in a study, although you cannot guarantee treatment, we watch very carefully, right? And this patient, she was an elder Hispanic woman, and she was thrilled, and we were going along, and then she had her 6 month with her physician, and then came back. And after seeing her doctor, and like literally was in tears in my office saying she was going to have to leave the study because her doctor was so upset that she was doing the trial. Because if you need something, I'm going to tell you what you need. And again, I'm just saying Hispanic woman because I identified with her as almost like my aunt or my mom. You right. know? And she was in tears, but her doctor was the person that she, you know, you listen to your doctor, you know, that's who she was. And for that doctor to say that without picking up the phone and saying, what is this about? Or, you know, I mean, he just took her off and made her feel terrible for doing this. And she was, obviously she trusted me enough to come back and tell me that that had happened. And so education starts everywhere. We need to educate our physicians. We need to educate, you know, our pharmacists. We need to educate our community in general. But definitely for the subjects to be aware, you have to reach out to the communities themselves. I know right now at our site, we have hired a community liaison person who's going to different physician practices, who's going to pharmacies, and hopefully she'll reach out to different organizations in the community, and I will go out and speak in the community. So I'm comfortable doing that. But really, it takes time, but making sure people have access and information are huge. I think I mentioned this at the conference that I wish pharma would pull their money and put a big ad about clinical trials, and instead of like each, you know, Pfizer drug or this drug with their big ads, if they pull their money, they would probably get so much better data and more diverse data just by one ad on TV that mirrors the ones that they're putting out now. And I know that's just like a pie dream, but letting people know how critical, you know, enrolling in a trial is. We cannot do this. We cannot have life-saving drugs without this step. We cannot do it without volunteers.
I think we're getting there. We're getting closer.
Yeah. I think maybe it's not as hopeless as I would have thought like a year or two ago, probably.
Right. I think the COVID-19 pandemic really galvanized the entire industry around health equity, the importance of clinical trials, period, the importance of diverse participation in clinical trials. So I think it was a painful step, but it was a great step forward for the entire industry to think about how we can improve outcomes together. So I think that was one great step in that direction. So I don't think it's quite a pipe dream, Margarita.
Good. I know that they do have some collaborations, you know, with drugs and stuff. So right. Maybe they can just do some collaborations with some ads.
Yeah, really?
In general.
They do work together. They could figure that out, right?
Exactly. Maybe somebody will call me after they hear this podcast. I'll give them some ideas.
So my next question, I realize, is kind of vague. What I meant by this question, how do you ensure inclusive strategies such as diversifying the workforce, community engagement, and patient advocacy partnerships? I guess what I meant is from a standpoint of, and I'm not going to get to this in a cohesive way, I'm sorry, but Dr. Nunez, you know, you mentioned the story about this elderly Hispanic woman, you know, and her doctor was so adamant and he didn't know about the clinical trials. And then if you have a site staff that maybe isn't aware of health inequities, or if the site staff itself doesn't make a person feel comfortable, or, you know, like individually, I guess, how do you ensure that the people that you do business with, you know, your sites, your patient advocacy, everybody, that they understand, you know, what they don't know, if that makes any sense, what I'm saying?
I think I know what you're saying. So I've seen bias in my own staff here, there, everywhere, just because we're all biased. I mean, I have my own biases, you know, I'm not saying I'm unique in this, but because I am going out of my way to make sure that I'm educated and that my staff is educated, but we actually have formal training for the staff. I am part of a larger network of AES, and we do have diversity training that is mandatory for everyone. And yes, we can have, you know, the videos and all that, but I also spend a lot of time, I guess I'm fortunate I'm full-time here. This is what I do. Yeah. And I do take people and do one-on-one with them. And especially if I hear things where they're, you know, it's easy when we are busy to say, oh, so-and-so is just not interested, or so-and-so is just, you know, they're grumpy or whatever. You need to come back and say, why do you think that is? Mm-hmm. Have you taken them back into your office and asked them? I think it happens even in physician practices. We've all been there. You know, you feel like you're one of a million, and it's kind of like being herded into a place to do something. But these people are volunteering their bodies. Okay. Without them, we have no data. Without them, we have nothing, right? No jobs. And so I make sure that my staff treats everyone, not only with respect and professionalism, because that's only the baseline, but to really find out what it is that makes someone not come to their appointments, or when they walk away, before they walk away, call me. Why are they walking away? And make sure that it's not lack of understanding, lack of information, or fear. What is it that they fear? And just present information in an unbiased way, as unbiased as possible. But yes, definitely. We also, you know, I know that Thermo Fisher has internship programs where they reach out to minority populations, and we have been part of that, where we can take their interns into our site and hire from that pool of qualified individuals as well. But really, it's once they're here, they have to be trained and their own biases kind of addressed or concerns.
Dr. Blackburn, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I took it a little differently, but I echo definitely what Margarita said about training, you know, at the very patient level and the site and staff level, talking to people about what their biases are and how it may show up in how they interact with patients. Mm-hmm. I think that's step one. On the other end of the spectrum, at the corporate level, we have company values and goals that reflect the need for a diverse workforce, with company-wide initiatives and community partnerships in place to build a diverse pipeline of scientists, clinical research professionals through exposure, like Margarita described, internship programs, fellowship programs in science and technology. So we have a big community-based STEM program, STEM outreach. We also have partnered with historically Black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, and Hispanic-serving institutions to identify and tap into pipeline programs that bring people in at different levels in the organizations, from early career, graduate students, and all the way across the organization. The other thing that's very effective in making sure that with the diverse workforce that we're being inclusive with the employees that we have. So we have well-established business resource groups that focus on leadership development, career advancement, retention, and we embed inclusion as well as a sense of fostering belonging and creating fair and a psychologically safe working environment. So we work, I think, at all levels of the organization to ensure that not only we're drawing from a diverse workforce and building a diverse pipeline of employees, but we're nurturing the diverse employees that we have and keeping them and, you know, working on retention and fostering development and advancement in the organization. So I think it's a, you know, really holistic approach down to the patient and site level that Margarita described as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The holistic approach so that everyone's kind of on the same page. Yeah.
The culture of the company, you need to make sure that
it's really embedded.
So Dr. Blackburn, you also worked on Capitol Hill and you have a strong interest in health policy for women and minorities from what I understand. So what is working and what isn't from a health policy standpoint for marginalized populations in your own opinion?
I think the diversity plan and what we've seen with it is a great example of policy and government and regulatory kind of coming together. So the FDA, the diversity plan draft guidance is a culmination of, you know, it came out in 2022, but there were guidances going back to the 80s and 90s about including women and then minority populations in clinical research. So I would say the diversity plan is a culmination across a pretty wide time span. And then that also becoming part of the omnibus bill, which undergirds it and puts it into law. I think it's a great example of the intersection of different branches of government, policymakers working together for the greater good. And in this case, you know, making trials more inclusive and representative. So I would say that's probably the perfect example of how it can work well for, and it was racial and ethnic diversity, but there have been other guidance around gender diversity, gender inclusion, and other ways to broaden trial eligibility. So I think there's been a culmination of that, and it's really exciting to see.
It seems like we reached kind of like a sweet point in this world with everything coming together. And as Rose mentioned earlier too, that the pandemic kind of brought to light not only the inequities in healthcare, but also the solutions, because we were not doing telemedicine when I'm in New York City. I'm in where the pandemic really started here in the hotspot. And we didn't have that option. It wasn't as common. And now all of a sudden we have the language and the technology, and although patients don't always have the access to the tools, which is another thing, decentralized trials and hybrid trials, we're combining local home health companies to go out to the homes of the patients who cannot come into the site. And then we can talk to them, you know, by Zoom or, you know, all these things that we didn't have before. So I think the policy and being able to reach out to the subjects, but knowing that you may have to, as a sponsor, as a site, give them the technology. I have patients in some of vaccines trials that can only do their diary when they go to the library and get on Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. So we're still a little bit long way of making sure that everyone has Wi-Fi, that everyone has access to the technology. But that is a big step.
We've had a lot of these opportunities, and the technology was available pre-pandemic, but companies were very reticent to try it. No one wanted to be the first. So we were ready with it when the pandemic hit, and then it became the kind of the only option to operationalize the trial and to keep trials that were in progress going. So it was good that it was there, and it was there. We had used it in small, very, very limited basis. But when the pandemic hit, it was easier to say, hey, we have this, we've used it a little bit, but now you can continue your studies. And that made a huge difference in the success of trials and being able to even conduct COVID-specific trials during the pandemic. So we were able to continue a lot of different indications because we had the technology, we had been developing it over the years.
It was pretty amazing how it all just, boom, it was there, yeah.
You're both accomplished physicians, you're both female, and maybe from an underrepresented ethnicity or race. And so I was wondering if you could share with the audience any potential bias that you have faced as a physician, and then maybe any bias or health inequities that you saw when you were practicing that negatively impacted your patients. I know you shared a couple of things, Margarita. I don't know.
I'll start a little bit. I think it's a great question about intersectionality. I think what's exciting is that women are making up now the majority of medical school classes. So over 50% of applicants and medical school graduates are women. So that's great progress and great news. I think in academic medicine leadership, it's not on par. So there's not as many women leaders in academia. In the CRO side and in industry, women are filling the ranks of leadership roles. But there, I think there's still a gap for women of color in leadership. So organizations have to be and are being intentional about developing and promoting women from all groups for leadership roles. What I've seen, and I was a women's health physician, so I could speak from that standpoint, you know, we know that women manifest diseases and symptoms differently for, say, heart disease compared to men. So sometimes symptoms are dismissed. So that's a bias. Sometimes, going back to Margarita's point about biases, about including women in a trial, if a woman shows up and she has a child, a toddler, an arm baby, no one might raise even a discussion about her entering a clinical trial that she might be eligible for because they think it'll be too much. So I think I've seen biases that way in clinical practice, as well as being a PI in a trial. So biases will filter through. I think we're doing better with training people about understanding what unconscious biases are. So I think we've made progress. We still have some work that needs to be done, though.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I have seen more women also. I think that, you know, my personal experience of being the only woman in the room many, many times, the only short Hispanic woman in the room. I always tell my staff when they, especially in phase one, they want you to wear uniforms and do scrubs. I said, when I wear scrubs, people hand me a bedpan. So I'm not going to wear scrubs. But it has gotten better. And I no longer feel that way in my day-to-day life. Partly, I am in a culture where I'm happy. I am happy with this, with the company where I'm working. But also, I think a little gray hair helps with that respect. But I do see, even in the stories that my patients tell me, and especially women of color, but I see it in men as well, where they're discounted, their symptoms are discounted, or they're not getting the workup that they deserve, that they need, you know, and because I don't treat them, right? I just follow the protocol, right. But I advise. I tell them, look, if your doctor is not listening to this, you need to switch doctors because this is a very important symptom. And I give them the language to go back to their doctor. And, you know, I have picked up the phone also and tried to communicate with their physician. But a lot of them just, you know, they're a little bit afraid of their doctor no longer treating them with the same or maybe getting rid of them. I don't know. They do have a fear. But I do see it a lot in some underserved populations. I do see that patients come in with untreated or unworked up conditions that in other communities, they would have had $1 million workup. So I do see that it is getting better. I'm hoping, you know, that it will get better. It'll continue to improve. But we have a ways to go, I think, as far as that's concerned.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing. I really appreciate your time. And thank you for being on our podcast.
Great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thanks.